Welcome back to the program. We're going to spend some time talking about the unique body of water that is San Francisco Bay, a remarkably resilient body of water given all of the urbanization that exists around it. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Ariel Rubiso Okamoto. She's the author of numerous books and articles about San Francisco Bay. Her latest is The Natural History of San Francisco Bay. It's part of the California Natural History Guides, and it is my pleasure to welcome her here to the program today. Ariel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's an honor.
Great to have you here. Talk a little bit about San Francisco Bay as a body of water that is seemingly constantly under siege. I mean, it exists within a pretty intense urban environment.
Well, I think that scientists like to say about San Francisco Bay that it's the most altered, the most manipulated, the most invaded estuary in the country. And I've thought a lot about that in terms of what it means. And I've actually tried to fact check it. It's a little bit difficult. But I think what it means is that we've basically tinkered with it for about 200 years. And we've rerouted the rivers and culverted the creeks and put up dams and moved water from one part of the state to another with big pumps. And we've, you know, filled in the marshes and filled in the bay so we could build on it. And we've reshaped the shorelines and dredged the shipping channels. And so you name it, we've done it to this estuary. So I think what's interesting, though, is that here in the 2000s, we've kind of come full circle. And we've learned some things from our mistakes, and we're trying to fix what we messed up. So, you know, what's exciting to me is that when you talk to scientists or wildlife managers, they're not complacent. They all think that we can do better. And one of the scientists that I quote in my book, who's Jan Thompson from the USGS, she likes to say, what better system to prove we can turn something around than something that's been so manipulated already and that we can still manipulate? So my excitement is exactly what you were just talking about, which is that we are in this incredible nexus of urbanization and ecological restoration, and we're the kind of area with the imagination to do something with it. And I like the idea that we're at a whole new frontier of environmental management, you know, where we're no longer trying to harness nature, we're trying to work with it and let nature do the work.
What does it tell us scientifically, the fact that it has been as resilient as it has, that it has been able to withstand this urbanization and still be at a point where it can be changed, it can be turned around?
I think it tells us, well, first of all, it's an estuary, which is an incredibly complex system. So there's the freshwater, there's the ocean tides, there's marshes that absorb some of our activities and filter our pollutants. There's, you know, a lot of flushing going on. I think and the region itself is this wonderful Mediterranean climate where, you know, almost everything works, everything grows, as you know, in the Napa Valley. I think it was already a pretty resilient system, and all the species in it were adapted to change and extremes. And even though we've kind of evened out all the extremes with all our management of it, they had a certain built-in resilience because it was so changeable already.
When you talk about the management of it, talk about what specifically you mean in terms of managing versus damaging.
Well, most of the management is upstream. As you know, we divert quite a bit of the estuary's waters to the south, to Southern California, and we, you know, water the entire Central Valley and all of our farmland from it. We've messed around with the plumbing a lot of this estuary so that the rivers that are coming into it and the bay itself are deprived of quite a bit of the fresh water that would normally help its species survive, especially the salmon, which are used to the freshwater flows. So when I'm talking about management, the original harnessing was the big dams and the, you know, agricultural irrigation intakes. I think then came the whole wave of diking and filling so we could, you know, make farmland and build. We built a lot of pieces of land right out into the bay, Treasure Island, you know, the airports, the freeways. All of that is a kind of management. And lately what we've been getting into, which is exciting, is to actually manage some more in order to reclaim some of the ecology that we lost. So we've been building wetlands, we've been taking creeks out of their culverts, we've been, you know, creating new species habitats that never were before. I think it's pretty exciting that we can do all this right next to 8 million people.
What have been the damages that have happened that are, if any, that are not reversible?
Well, we have some sort of ancient pollutants that are just not going to go away. We have the good old DDT and PCBs and mercury that came down from the hydraulic gold mining during the gold rush. You know, they used mercury to attract the gold, and they mixed it with all their they mixed it with the gold, and it came down into our system. So these so-called legacy pollutants are sitting down there in the bottom of the bay, and you really can't do anything. You can't go down there and get them and take it away. We banned them a long time ago, but they're still there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is disturbing to scientists right now is that the bay used to be depositional. In other words, there was always new sediment coming down and laying down on top of these legacy contaminants, and they would they were kind of sequestered there and safe. And now what's happening is that flush of sediment that used to come down is washed out now, and the bottom of the bay, especially up in San Pablo Bay, is beginning to erode. And so I think they're worried that some of these legacy contaminants are going to come back to haunt us.
To what extent has greater environmental awareness, particularly here in the Bay Area, enabled this process to continue to move forward in terms of restoration?
Well, I think it's played an enormous role. I mean, from the beginning in the 60s when those three wonderful women created the Save the Bay movement till today, I think we are a hotbed of environmental activity and awareness and activism here in the Bay Area and in Northern California. And I think that because of that, Californians have voted consistently for more restoration, cleaner water, cleaner air. They're not afraid to vote for those things and to pay for them with their tax dollars. And I think that as a result, you in the Napa Valley paid for it for your Napa River floodplain project, which
mm-hmm.
is terrific. That is an investment that's going to put us miles ahead of everybody else in the country when we deal with climate change and, you know, job loss and environmental degradation.
What are the anticipated problems to the Bay as a result of a potential climate change?
Well, as you know, as you've seen in the Napa Valley, the Napa River goes up and down with the tides. There's a lot of the bay that is very close to the water level. A lot of it was built on fill. Downtown San Francisco was built on a bed of gold rush ships that were abandoned. All our airports are built on fill that used to be bay. All those areas are very susceptible to sea level rise, and I think that the Bay Area is going to be especially susceptible to sea level rise because of that. And it's kind of a challenge and an exciting opportunity for us because we've built a lot of wetlands, for example, which can absorb this rising sea level and help buffer us from it. But we need to do more. But we also have, you know, downtowns right on the waterfront where I don't know whether we're going to build a big seawall or not, but we may have to consider such things.
What are some of the restoration projects that haven't been done yet? What are some of the things that you, for example, would like to see happening?
Well, I think there's been an enormous amount of planning, and I think one of the biggest concerns that people who do restoration have is they've started some really, really big projects. You know, the restoration of an enormous quantity of South Bay salt ponds and North Bay salt ponds. And there's a lot of projects in progress that have suffered from the sudden change in the economy and the state funding for these things. And I think that if they can be finished and seen through to the end, that will be an enormous benefit for us. I would like to see more projects like the Napa River restoration where this is my personal opinion, but
mm-hmm.
I'm really excited about the fact that you actually moved buildings and people out of the floodplain and gave it back to the river because, you know, if you look at Katrina and you look at any of these disaster areas, it's clear that people shouldn't be there in the first place. And to have the courage and, you know, the foresight to move away from it and do something else and let our waters flood where they normally would have flooded, is going to be of enormous benefit as we deal with sea level rise in the Bay Area.
What are the big projects that still need to happen?
Well, the South Bay salt ponds and the North Bay salt ponds really need to be finished. And unfortunately, you know, wetlands take about 50 years to come back. So you can't just sort of do it overnight and see a nice green wetland. Usually you see a big glistening field of mud for a while, and then you might see some green shoots. And it takes a long time to make a mature wetland that can support clapper rails and salt marsh harvest mice and some of the endangered species that we're trying to save. And I think it's not sexy, and there isn't a particular place or project that I can point to, but I think that we have incredible plans in the works, and we just have to follow up and finish them.
Is there any controversy within the scientific community, with those working on these various projects, about different ways in which some of these things need to be done to restore certain areas of the bay?
Well, I think there are many opinions about how to do restoration, and one of the things that I'm excited about that's in my book is, you know, two whole chapters on restoration, because I think that kind of information isn't out there yet in the written world. Or it's buried in, you know, government reports that no one can find. But I think that there has been debate for a long time about things like, should you, you know, plant a do a planting in a wetland to speed the process of vegetation? Should you alter the terrain so that it's at a better tidal level for things to grow? Should you, just break open an old dike so that the tides can come in and let nature do the work? There are controversies about how to do these things, but most of them, I think there's quite a bit of agreement now about how we should do them. And the question before us today is to, do we have the sort of wherewithal and the foresight to monitor what we've done and learn from our mistakes and, you know, follow up and change things? I think there's been a controversy for a long time about the difference between shorebird habitats and salt marsh, which are two different kinds of marsh habitats, and can you displace one species to make way for another, and is that a fair thing? And I think the new thinking is that there will be stages of every restoration in which different species will be served, and that's okay.
Talk a little bit about this guide, this Natural History of the San Francisco Bay, and a little bit about what people can find in there.
Well, before I did this interview, I Googled San Francisco Bay, and I got 92 million Google points. And then I narrowed it down to San Francisco Bay environment, and I think I got, only slightly less. There's a lot of information about San Francisco Bay, and I think what's in this book it's very dense, but it's very condensed, and it's well organized, and it's almost every story in it is not more than 3 pages long. So it has a lot of science. It has a lot of little anecdotes about, you know, what it takes to work in the bay and to do research in the bay and people's experiences in the bay. It has historical stories about its history. And, it had an amazing history of being an incredible fishing area, and wouldn't it be nice if we could do that again? So the book is, but most centrally, I think the book is about the bay, the water, and what's in it, rather than the bay area.
What are we learning about the impact of shipping with respect to the bay?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because I think in the old days when I was writing about these issues, people used to call me the dredge queen, because I was always writing about dredging for the Army Corps of Engineers. But I think that shipping, the major concern now is the invasive species that are being brought in on these ships and how they're taking over our bay. And I think there's a controversy right now, and in fact there are some hearings going on in the EPA right now about how we should manage the ballast water that ships carry in order to remain stable. The ballast water gets taken up in one port and released in another, and it's full of all kinds of things that we may not want here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons they call the bay the most invaded estuary in the world. I don't know if that's actually documentable, but I think that ships are a part of the bay. They're part of our landscape and our history, and what we need to think more about is managing the impacts of the invasive species that come with them, and also about when we dredge our shipping channels in order to make way for these big ships. can we use the material that we dredge in these new wetlands that we're making, because we actually kind of don't have enough sediment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing that's going on that everybody is, anybody knows about, is the oil spills that we risk. In fact, I was on the San Francisco Bay is kind of like a little bathtub. You spill some oil and it just sloshes back and forth and it doesn't have anywhere to go. So I think that we need to be even more careful about guiding these big ships into the bay so they don't hit the Bay Bridge.
What have we found to be the impact of these invasive species?
Well, they displace the natives. It hasn't been such a problem in the deeper part of the bay, in the central bay, where there are still quite a few native species. It gets to be, it's become a big problem in the North Bay, more up in your area, where we have this invasive Chinese clam, or they call it the overbite clam, which has been so prolific and is so good at eating everything in the water that it's kind of taken out a whole big chunk of the food web for some of our most endangered species, like Delta smelt and some of the estuarine species that live in that zone between the rivers and the sea. So that's one impact. There's, there was a mitten crab that was clogging up the federal pumps for a while, and they had to build a big piece of machinery to get this crab out of the plumbing works. Then there's the zebra mussel that everybody is very worried about coming our way, because in the Great Lakes region, it's cost millions of dollars to keep this thing out of the pipes. And some of the scientists here say that they're not sure that it can survive in some of our waterways, and there's always hope. But if the zebra mussel came here and got into our plumbing systems upstream, it would be a major problem for California.
Once these species are introduced to the environment, what, if anything, can change that?
It's all about prevention. And it's interesting. I mean, in my book, I kind of say this, that the best thing to do is to stop it from getting here in the first place. So what you really want to do is you want to treat the ballast water before it's discharged, or you want to, that recreational boat that might have been on a lake in Nevada that had a species that we didn't want that's trailered out here and put on Lake Berryessa, you want to make sure it's clean and all of its, motor, everything, the filters are all cleaned out before you put it in the water, because something as small as that can bring something that we really don't want. I think you've probably heard about the northern pike. This is a big, very big fish that was introduced into a lake. I forget exactly where, but somewhere in the foothills. And they had to do bomb blasts to try to kill this thing. It's so big. And they've had a very hard time getting it out of that lake. So I think the front line is, don't let it get into the water, because once it's into the water, it's very hard to control it. We can't, spray the bay and kill everything in it just to get rid of a few things that we don't want. We'd kill everything.
The results of globalization of the bay, I suppose.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of people are talking now about, maybe we will never be able to go back to this idyllic, historic bay, which was so rich and full of wildlife, because now we have a global bay. We have a bay that's full of other species, and there's a big debate right now about Atlantic cordgrass, for example, and Pacific cordgrass. Atlantic cordgrass has been colonizing a lot of our wetlands, and the little endangered clapper rails are, using it, as well as the local Pacific cordgrass. And what do you do? How do you decide which is better for them?
How is that going to be decided?
Well, that's a very big issue, and I'm going to stay out of it.
Okay. When you say it's a big issue, it's become a political issue? Is that what's happened with it?
Well, it's the ongoing thing about a lot of endangered species that live in this very urbanized bay. They've adapted to tough environments, and they've made the best with what they have around them. So there's always this line between, do we want to give them their pristine historic habitat, do we want to try to recreate that, or you know, is it okay to let them live on the fringes of things? Is it okay to let the peregrine falcons nest in our bridges? You know, and isn't that the wave of the future, and isn't that the way we should be thinking? Because after all, we're going to be here for a while.
Ariel Rubiso Okamoto, her book is Natural History of San Francisco Bay. It is just out from University of California Press. Ariel, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.